Hey, Larry.
Hi, Andy.
What's happening?
Oh, a little bit of this and that, but mainly the same old grind of doing my day job and my night job.
I don't want to know anything about that night job. Have you guys had any
Well, it,
springtime weather there?
we have indeed. It's
Excellent.
real nice here today.
Excellent. If you're listening to us via the website, we're delighted to have you, but it'd be easier for you and better for us if you made us part of your feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or TuneIn. If you like what you hear, please write a review. If you don't, forget everything I just said. I probably should change that to fuck you people. You can support us at patreon.com/registrymatters. Even a dollar contribution would be greatly appreciated. So, Larry, guess what?
What's up, Andy?
We have a guest tonight.
Oh, my goodness.
We are being joined by Brenda Jones of the National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws. Welcome, Brenda. So happy to have you. And I would like to extend a very heartfelt fuck you people to you for joining us. Brenda, you do a lot of you do a truckload of advocacy work for the movement. You're the executive director at NARSOL, but you also work for your local state affiliate called FAIR. What does FAIR stand for?
Hey there, Andy, and Larry. FAIR stands for Families Advocating Intelligent Registries. So, almost as much of a mouthful as National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws.
How long you've guys been around?
We got started back in 2010.
And have you guys had any success doing anything?
Yeah, we actually have. In part, I actually thanks to Larry, who I met at about the same time. I got started in, really it started at the very beginning of 2010 when there were a whole bunch of bills that were being filed. I had just got involved in the advocacy movement when a family member had been headed off to prison, and I just learned about the AWA, which I think you guys have talked about in the past. So I knew that laws often got named after some poor victim. And there was this really high-profile crime that happened right about Christmas time in 2009, and I went, "Oh my gosh, I wonder if that's going to trigger a bunch of new legislation in our state," and it did. I knew nothing about the legislature. I knew nothing about. I mean, my idea of being politically active was to go find somebody who thought kind of like me and ask them how I should vote. That was about my limit. So I didn't know anything, but I knew that there was a world of hurt with all of these sex offense laws, and I couldn't just sit there and not do anything. So I put out a call and I said, "Help! I have no idea what I'm doing." And through hook and by crook, I got connected up with Larry, who's many, many states away, and he kind of walked me through tracking bills and just focusing on things. And there were 84 bills that year, Andy. 84
84
bills
related to registry stuff?
related to sex offense laws. There were
Jesus.
about five different versions of the Adam Walsh Act, all got introduced, and not surprisingly, it did get passed. But we've since overturned it. But that year, there was no stopping it. No matter what we did. What we did manage to do, partly with Larry's help, was to make sure that the super retroactivity was out of it. The retroactivity that would have gone back and grabbed anybody ever who'd convicted a was convicted of a sex offense. So that got taken out. There was kind of a limit to how far back they could go. And on a separate bill, we did manage to kill the one that there was one bill that was trying to institute residency restrictions. Maryland doesn't have any. And one bill was proposing, I don't remember if it was 1,000 feet, maybe. And I think it was my testimony, it was my proudest moment, was my testimony getting up there and doing a show and tell of, look, here's what's left that got that bill killed.
Well, not to
So,
make this like the Larry's Awesome Show, but can you two dialogue back and forth on Larry? Can you describe how you introduced watching Bills and how you guided Brenda through, I've never heard how this story comes to be, but how you would have helped, how would you help anybody, not just a Brenda, but Brenda just being a person, just a kind, you know, a normal person, you know, not somebody that's politically active or understands the stuff by second nature like you do, but can you talk us through how you may have helped her?
I didn't really have to do a lot on helping her track Bills. She actually was quite computer savvy and knew how to set up the monitoring to track Bills and keywords and stuff. So that wasn't really where my help was most useful. The help was more in strategy and explaining how the system works. And the way that worked, it would be a conversation or two every single day for basically all these years that we've known each other. So we would analyze Bills and talk about them. And it was one of those things where it was unfortunate that I was only doing it for one person rather than doing it for more than one person, because the same principles would apply. The differences I noticed in Brenda that I've seldom run into is that she was actually, although she didn't understand it, she was willing to learn. And she's willing to accept things the way they are. And when I tell people I don't write the rules for life, I simply tell you what they are when it comes to legislation. I mean, she accepts those and understands that this is what we're dealing with. And so the capacity to learn and accept that this is what you have to do to succeed in this environment. She knows that she can't go cuss out lawmakers and tell them how stupid they are and expect them to vote for her. We've got people who, despite my advice, do that. They go and say nasty, ugly things to them and tell them what trash they are, and they somehow don't understand how they don't win them over. So it was a combination of her already having enormous skills that were useful, and in terms of helping me, it's been mutually beneficial, because a lot of things that I need help with in terms of technology and getting things to look pretty and making it well organized, she helps me with. But in terms of, it was just a lot of conversations and explaining things for I mean, I don't think there's any way to calculate how many hours we've talked strategy.
Hang on, wait a minute. Hang on, just 1 second. So if Brenda would have said to you, fuck you people, you wouldn't have helped her?
You mean to the people in the legislature?
No, if Brenda you would have said that to Larry probably wouldn't have been so willing to help you, using that to contrast about the people going to the legislators, cussing them out and whatnot, saying.
Yeah, fortunately for me, my natural way of functioning is I wear very rosy glasses. It's a running gag, actually,
Jones colored
glasses. Yep. And so, you know, I treat everybody pretty much the same, and they all put on their pants one leg at a time. And I know they've all got kids that they go home to. So while they can occasionally piss me off, I wouldn't go in there that way. But, you know, but Larry did give me a heads up before I went there that, you know, you got to build a relationship, you need to work with them. And it made sense to me. So even though I didn't really have a clue yet what I was going to say, you know, I went in and just said, hey, sir, we don't like this bill. We dislike it. And that was enough as a start. I wanted to kill a lot of bills. You know, I mentioned all those different AWA bills, and I remember a conversation I had with Larry back then, where, you know, he was going, you know, Brenda, you're not going to be able to stop that from passing. But Larry, I've got to stop it. He's going, it's not going to happen. And he explained why. And I didn't like it, and I was highly frustrated, but, you know, we just did what we could. And yeah, so anyway, I thought that there's got to be some way, but Larry said, it's not going to happen, and I just had to take his word for it. I often will say that I spent all these years with Larry basically beating it into my head with a mallet. I don't know if it ever really was that way, but I felt sometimes like it took that long to work things out.
It takes a long time to retrain. You know, I mean, we all have 20, 30, 40, 50 years, whatever those numbers are, of years of where we think the system works a certain way, and we have no way to validate whether it does or doesn't until we decide to get involved. And it's a pretty steep learning curve in changing a way of thinking and getting yourself into the mode of how to attack this whole thing, whether we're fighting for the registry kind of situation or we're trying to fight some sort of local climate change law, whatever those things are.
Definitely. And it was that first year was definitely a wake up call. We took groups of us around. We continued the following year. There were kind of aftershocks where they tried to go after some stuff they didn't get the first time around. And the other big thing for us, I think, was regulations, which that's what I learned comes out after a law is passed. And in my non-technical terms, you know, somebody they passed the AWA. Okay, fine. You know, we've got three tiers. It's going to take place on, you know, X date when the law kicks in. But then they kick it over to whatever, in this case, the Department of Public Safety, to make it happen. And they've got to put the meat on the bones. I mean, the law is the bones, and then they go put the meat on it. And they went way beyond what was in the law. You know, the law said notify, and they put in the regulations continuously verify. It was just, you know, just tons and tons of stuff, things to report that weren't in the law. We found out about that and discovered there was a legislative committee that met. What did they call it? It was a bicameral committee, not bicameral. It was both chambers. That met.
It was a joint House Senate committee.
Joint House Senate committee. And Larry put his strategist hat on as to what would work best on that. And one of the reasons probably that I was so easy to work with in that context is I was a total blank slate. I went, okay, now what? And, you know, so he said, well, you know, they're going to really hate the legislatures are going to hate that the other branch of government is out there making their laws for them. It's going to drive them right up a wall. So we need to make sure they know that the Department of Public Safety has gone way beyond what they actually put into law. And so we did. And, you know, I'm going around knocking on doors of every committee member and having conversations. Some of them were, yeah, fine, whatever. Some of them who were not on our side. I remember going up and one particular conversation with an enemy type legislator, shall we say, and talking to his secretary. I said, I need to get this to the delegate, and because we're very concerned that these regulations are going to pass and they're going to be, you know, way harsher than they should be. Now, that was my quick spiel. And she just looked up at me and said, and that's a problem. Why? And my eyes got really big back, and I said, because it's unconstitutional. That was my response. I wasn't laughing at the time. I was just like, that's the problem. And I didn't say any more. I didn't engage her further. I could see it was totally pointless. But I had my little comeback. I left my info, and I went out of the room. And as a result of that, though, cut a long story short, they called a hearing. They didn't always call hearings. It was often rubber stamp on these regulations. They called a hearing on it. And because of the work that we did with Larry's help, you know, writing up, hey, look at all this stuff that went above and beyond, even several of our enemies, you know, who would normally be, you know, saying, yeah, let's crack down, were standing up and quizzing the Department of Public Safety people going, why are you doing this? Why did you do this? This wasn't in our bill. This wasn't in the law that we passed. Well, we're trying to comply with the federal government. If we'd wanted to comply with the federal government, we would have put it in the law, right? And he turns around and looks at one of our other arch enemies, And so it was a very proud moment, and we were very tickled at how that came out. In the end, those regulations were tabled, and to my knowledge, they've never, and this is years ago now, managed to come up with another set. So they're just limping along with their old ones. The AWA happened, but the new regulations did not.
So. Well, Andy, that would be an example. That would be an example of where I had. She's minimized the strategy. We went full throttle with the legislature. We contacted county attorneys because of the unfunded mandate that was going to put on county attorneys. We contacted officials at the local and county level because they were going to potentially have them in a liability situation. But we had people in Maryland who actually did what I asked rather than telling me that they were smarter. They actually went and got the information. They got it to the people that we deemed appropriate. And we got people making contact with lawmakers from county officials, county attorneys, county commissioners, whatever they call them there. We had a united front of people working. And it, in some cases, like if people, you have to trust people that know. We had a call just a few weeks ago, a couple months ago, about the Pennsylvania, the bill that was on the governor's desk, and I said the governor will sign it, and one of the persons from Pennsylvania, our expert, said, "Oh, there's a chance." No, there actually is no chance. The governor's going to veto that, and here's why. And I can tell people why they won't do something and why they will do something because I understand it, but I can't tell you if you don't want to learn. So I can only help those who are open. And Brenda's been very receptive to learning. So that's how this relationship has worked. Is that we've helped each other. She has helped me on things that I've struggled to do, and I've helped her on things that she struggles to do. And I'm glad that I've been involved with Brenda because a lot of my work is easier because of her.
There you go. So to Brenda, though, if you didn't have that guidance and, you know, me working in computers and looking for proof of something, you know, we're going to make like a hypothesis about something, and we're going to see if it can play through. In your experience, Larry, don't get a big ego over this. Did Larry, I don't want to say ever, did Larry ever say something would be and it didn't end up to be?
Oh, you know, I can tell you one idea, but it wasn't politics. But go ahead.
There's been a couple of times, but I think in terms of politics and strategy, I've never had that drop. I remember one of my proudest moments was when I had been scouring the new law and trying to come up with the interpretation of habitually lives. One of the changes in the law altered our definition of habitually lives to capture people who were at a place for a short period of time but not actually spending the night there, that kind of thing. And there was a definition that had popped up over in one place that said, now I don't remember what it was, like more than 5 hours three times a month. It was I'm blanking on what it is.
More than 5 hours.
Times in a
continuous hours.
Like that. I mean, you could go and stay at the Starbucks, you know, two or three times, or visit grandma once a week, and it would, you know, that would qualify. But it was written in one place, and he was convinced that it wasn't, you know, that I couldn't pick it up and insert it over here where it said habitually lives. And we had the biggest back and forth. I said, Larry, it's here. I swear it is. And finally he said, oh, look at that. It really does go over here. So that was my proudest moment, is that I got that sorted out first before he did. But usually strategy wise, I've not ever found anybody that could top him in terms of legal or other strategies. So it can go straight to his head if he wants to.
Well, I think a lot of people would be very apprehensive about doing something, not knowing what the next turn would entail. And you know, having some sort of mock scenario. Hey, look, when you do this, this is going to be their next move. When you do this, this is going to be their next move. At least being aware of that. And it is super duper helpful to have someone that can at least kind of chop through those areas of conflict. To help you be prepared for them when they do come about.
It's been very gratifying for me that now, in spite of the fact that I feel like I'm still pretty darn I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I know, but I don't do just because I work a full-time job and I've still got family and stuff, but I know things. And so I'll get calls from some of our affiliates or a new contact or somebody who's trying to hit the legislature, and I'll give them some tips and advice at the very basic level, of course, because that's all I really know. And know that actually is helping them. And I've hearing Larry as I tell him stuff, you know, because it's all stuff that he's, like I say, pounded into my head over the years. But I've walked him through what to say or how to say it better so that it's, you know, staying on point and sticking to the bill and not wandering off about other things to do with the AWA that's nothing to do with the bill. Just, you know, simple things like that. So it's been really, that's gratifying that I'm now passing it on to some degree, passing it on.
That's pretty cool. Larry, do you have any questions? Anything you want to ask Brenda?
So, no, I think we've done enough ego boosting now. So let's move on to these.
Okay.
Move on to these exciting news articles.
So this is from the LA Times. 8 reasons for America's shameful number of wrong convictions. This is written by John Grisham. So at the in the beginning of the article, he says the rate of wrongful convictions in the United States is estimated to be somewhere between 2 and 10%. And then goes on, if there are 2.3 million people in prison in the United States, that's somewhere between 46 and 230,000 people that are locked up that are potentially innocent. This is, you know, there's that quote, and I know I'm going to screw it up, but it's better to let one guilty man go free than to have 99 locked up.
100 guilty go free.
100 guilty go free than have one innocent man lock up.
Yeah, so
that's totally what this is.
It is indeed, Andy. It is indeed.
And so a lot of this comes from false confessions where they describe in the article where people get put under really harsh interrogation conditions. Maybe you're locked in a room for 10 hours. Maybe they at least kind of say you can't go to the bathroom, or you're thirsty and they just give you tiny little cups of water. And eventually you're just like, screw it. It can't get any worse. I mean, if I'm not guilty, I'm not guilty. So they admit to doing something, just like, God, I got to go home and take care of my kids or whatever. And then later down the line, somehow DNA evidence exonerates them. But you're not going to overcome that confession in court.
That becomes difficult. False confessions. People listening to the podcast that have had no experience with the justice system, your gut instinct says, I would never confess or plead to something I didn't do. But you have to be in the circumstance of being in an interrogation room for an extended period of time. And the games that are played, seldom is the interrogee, the interrogated person, they're always alone almost all the time. And the interrogators are always working in teams.
Right.
And they have the good cop and they have the bad cop. And they tell people stuff that's not true. And the courts have said it's okay to mislead people to extract a confession. So they will tell you that they have evidence that they don't have, and that you ought to come clean because it'll go easier on you. Well, if you've never experienced a justice system before, and you've got these people you've always been taught to admire and trust, they're telling you that they've got evidence. Now, of course, if you know that you didn't do it, you don't know how they have this evidence, but they'll tell you that two people saw you.
Right.
That we've got two eyewitnesses, and we've got such and such that links you to it. We've got, I mean, they'll make up stuff out of the clear blue and say that they have it. So you end up extracting confessions from people by a whole lots of things that are questionable in terms of police tactics, in terms of long interrogations without any representation, and circumstances that are somewhat trying. If you put someone under bright lights and keep them answering questions for 12 hours straight, there's only so much a human can take. So although the average listener says, I would never confess to something I didn't do, I would say that you need to wait till you find yourself in that situation. And when you have people telling you things that they have on you that they're going to use against you, and how they paint a dismal portrayal of what prison's going to be like, because we can convict you if you don't work with us of all these charges, the most serious charges, and we're ready to cut a deal. So,
Larry,
so
are you saying that cops and prosecutors aren't honest, hardworking professionals?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that in their hard work, that they do things that are very questionable in their tactics. So you should not tell a person untrue things, but the courts have said it's okay to do that. So they do. They do it because they can. One of my favorite lines.
That is one of your favorite lines. Well, all right. So just because I want to say this again, can you, being interrogated, can you say, fuck you people?
You can. And they tell you that at the very beginning, that in a custodial interrogation, that you have the rights under the Miranda decision to remain silent. And they tell you that. And they tell you that everything that you say can and will likely be used against you. And the smart person would say, well, you've told me all I need to know. I'll invoke my right to remain silent. But very few people do that because, like I say, they have a team and you're there alone. And they're telling you that they're there to help you. And you were taught 30 years of your life that the cop is there to help you and your friend. It's hard for you to make that adjustment on the spur of the moment. After the cop has told you you've had the right to remain silent and everything you may say will be used against you, it's hard for you to do away with 20 years of programming that the cop is not your friend. So you're inclined to want to trust that person.
They also have, the board is slanted in their favor. There's no risk on their side of telling you whatever they tell you. And it's all in their favor if they get you to cop to something, but there's no consequence if you remain silent and play tough. All of the consequences are on your side. You have personal responsibilities. Everything is against you at that point. There's no advocate in your corner. They have all the resources.
You're correct, but the person doesn't understand that unless they've
correct.
Been in the rodeo
I'm with you.
Many, many times. They don't understand that. If the cop has all the evidence that they need, they don't need to interrogate you. So they would simply put you in the cell and say, we intend to put you in the electric chair and have a great day. The only reason the cop is interrogating you is because they need your confession. But the person doesn't realize that.
They have some level of, I'm sure there's a word here that I'm looking for. They have reasonable suspicion. We've talked about these when we were talking about the interstate compact. I'm sorry, when you transfer and you're going a revocation hearing, that's what I'm thinking of. And it's like the lowest level of evidence. I forgot what the word is. Remind me, please.
So, well, there's reasonable suspicion, probable
okay,
cause.
Reasonable. So at what level do they have to even get you to come in?
Well, it can vary from it doesn't take much to ask a person to go downtown. See, there again, when a cop comes to your door and says, we'd like to talk to you downtown, are I'm under arrest? No. Well, if you were me, you'd say, well, we'll have a conversation just fine right here. I'd choose not to go downtown.
Sure.
But the average person doesn't do that. They don't tell them that. So they end up voluntarily going downtown. And then the more they talk, yeah. the more they need to talk because they tell them enough to where the cop is beginning to build that level that they need for a detention. The evidence, I mean, they usually have a little something to take you down. They have some suspicion that draws you into the investigation, whether you be a witness or whether you be a participant. They have something that they would like to talk to you about. You can turn yourself in from being a witness to a suspect by simply what you say once you get downtown.
Right.
They may have thought you were a witness, and they may determine that you're a suspect. But talking without the advice of counsel is generally a very bad idea. But
what do you do about people that just, you know, look, I make minimum wage, I make 10 bucks an hour, whatever, and I can't afford to hire someone at 200 bucks an hour to come in and be my advocate?
Well, that poses the problem. And technically, they're supposed to stop the interrogation if you assert that right to an attorney until they provide you an attorney. Now, cops have been known in rare circumstances to provide you a bogus attorney.
Really?
Somebody, yeah, it's rare circumstances. So I didn't mean to say that this happened all the time.
I'm with you.
Most cops do see to it that they stop the interrogation. Now, under recent Supreme Court decision, I can't cite the name of the case, but they kind of made it a little easier for the cops to come back and try again once you've said no. You have to continue to reassert your right to remain silent. But in ideal circumstances, they're supposed to provide you with an attorney if they want to continue the interrogation.
We probably could do a whole show on this, but so if just to dig a little deeper, can you, is there any sort of time limit on how long it takes them to get an attorney? Or is it just they have some sort of speed dial list and they start running down the list of 20, 30 attorneys until one will come in and talk to you?
It would be variable to their jurisdiction, how long a person can be held in custody without having charges filed. So there would be no exact answer.
But it could be from hours to days or weeks?
It could be from hours to a few days. I don't think it would be weeks that they would have to either charge you with something or let you go. But it could certainly be for hours or maybe a few days.
And so if they do hold you, then, you know, you end up losing your job, whatever. There's no consequence on their end for any of this, false accusations or anything, is there?
Well, not in a direct sense. No, there's no consequences because the police enjoy a very high level of immunity for their work. That's kind of the way it has to be. So if they're conducting an investigation and they have the necessary requisite level of suspicion or probable cause to bring you in, and it turns out that it doesn't go anywhere, they let you go. So in that article, there's a whole lot more causes
there's sleeping, a number judges, of judges, bad lawyering, well, junk well, science,
bad police work the police often they jump to conclusions too soon about the course of investigation, and a high profile case out of Boulder, Colorado, with the Ramseys, they just knew that the family did it.
Right.
And they focused so hard on the Ramsey family that the true killer of JonBenet got away. That's one thing. Bad police work zeroes in on the wrong suspect. And then you have prosecutorial misconduct, which is anything from prosecutors withholding exculpatory evidence that would have mitigated or totally exonerated the person, to looking the other way with perjury. When you're a criminal defense attorney, criminal defense attorneys are very ethical. They tell their clients, once they've confessed to them, I will not put you on the stand and let you lie. I've not met very many prosecutors in my experience that they tell the police officer, if you get on that stand and you say what you just said now, since I know that's a lie, I will bring you up on charges of perjury.
Right.
That same standard doesn't apply on the other side.
Why not?
I can't answer that. We'd have to get a prosecutor to come on here and explain that. But I would imagine that it would be something similar to the reason why prosecutors that do bring charges to cops for misbehavior, including murder, that they never get a conviction. So juries are very hesitant to do anything about police misconduct. So that may be a part of it, but I'd love to hear from a prosecutor on that. But you have the bad lawyer, and it contributes. You have jailhouse snitches that rat people out for stuff they didn't do to buy favors. I mean, you've got forensic science. It's totally junk science, but the defense side doesn't have the access to the funding that they need. Forensics has evolved in the last 20, 25 years to where you have the courtroom in trial settings is just loaded with experts. It's hardly a trial except for maybe low-level misdemeanors that don't involve experts nowadays. And the prosecution has a boatload of experts from all the various law enforcement agencies, and the defense usually is very limited because of underfunded public defender services. They can't match that. So all they can do is take a few pot shots at the expert that's been qualified by the court for the prosecution, and they don't get to come back and discredit the junk science. Very few people have the O.J. Simpson resources where they called out the junk science and the bogus investigation done by the LA police.
Right. Yeah. If you want some sort of counter to their expert, you have to hire your own expert, and you're talking thousands of dollars to bring those people in.
You are talking that, and the good taxpayers out there just don't see the need because they believe with all their heart that their police are outgunned, understaffed, overworked, and would never bring a case unless they had the goods on them. So the people are just own up, take responsibility, plead guilty, and get it over with. And the citizens are not ready to fund public defender resources at the level that they need it, taking into account the evolving society and the standards of evidence that we have now. Times have changed. Crimes are not, trials don't go forward the way they did 30 years ago. What you see in a courtroom now doesn't resemble anything out of the Perry Mason days.
So from the Washington Post, Oklahoma says it will begin using nitrogen for all executions in an unprecedented move. This was disturbing, Larry. I remember their execution from a few years ago where they had the wrong concoction and the dude flailed around and it was nasty. And now they're just going to use nitrogen gas, which would ultimately make you suffocate, I believe. I think that's how you would go down if you breathed nitrogen. So they would take the oxygen out of the air and that's how you would go down.
I found it troubling myself, and I don't know where we're headed with executions, because states that are adamant on having the death penalty, which tends to be all over the southern United States in the conservative jurisdiction. So we've made strides in some states in rolling back capital punishment, my state being one of them, Nebraska being one, until the voters by referendum reinstated the death penalty. But we just have this thirst for vengeance in this country, and we can't overcome it for some reason. We just can't help ourselves. We like to put people in the death chamber. So they will search for whatever means they can. If they can't use the three-drug concoction, which I'm not a chemist, I don't understand it, but I think there was a three-drug concoction that had become the common way of executing people.
Yes.
And if they can't get that concoction, they're going to find a way. And some states have just brought back the barbaric ways of firing squad and the electric chair and just whatever it takes to put the person to death. We're moving backwards, in my opinion.
I was speaking to somebody recently, and they said, well, you know, in some countries, when you steal something, they cut off your hand. Why don't we go? And, you know, we should have more executions in life in prison. I was like, seriously?
Well, if you take a poll but you find yourself shocked. I think I saw a poll recently, about 70% of the of Americans favor using a nuclear weapon in Korea, if even it means 2 million people die. So I'm not surprised that I think we can't undo the conditioning of our society overnight, and we believe. A significant number of Americans believe that the death penalty is proper. I think they take some kind of biblical quote from eye for an eye. They tie that mm-hmm. together and say that this is the proper course of action for someone. And we respect life so much that as the state, we are entitled to take life from those who have screwed up. And I, at one time, I'll confess, I thought the death penalty was a deterrent. I've come, as I've gotten older, to study and see that I can't find that it's a deterrent. I can't see the evidence that supports it. I can see a lot of evidence that's contrary, that it's arbitrary, and I can see evidence that there's no appreciable difference. In fact, states without death penalties have lower homicide rates than states with the death penalty. So I've evolved to the point that I think the death penalty is barbaric and should be relegated to the scrap heaps of our past.
Well, if you back up to the previous article, and if the number's as high as 10%, then 230,000 people could possibly be executed that are innocent.
Well, that was all crimes. That was not just capital crimes. But if you took just the number of people on death row, which in California, it's hundreds and hundreds and maybe thousands now. If you took that, extrapolated that same percentage, you would have a lot of people that would be executed that would be innocent across the country. And you take California with a high death row, Texas with another high death row population, Georgia has a fairly high rate. All over the South, they're in the Bible Belt, they're capital punishment obsessed. So California is really the only non-Southern state that has a huge death row population.
I don't like it, but I don't have anything much to add.
Well, your state doesn't do the death penalty.
We do not. We got that overturned, and people keep muttering about bringing it back, but I don't think the bills ever go anywhere.
So this next one is from the Marshall Project, and it's a commentary. And let's put an end to prosecutorial immunity. The time has come to create some level of accountability for prosecutors. According to Taylor versus Kavanaugh, based upon Supreme Court law, the falsification of evidence and the coercion of witnesses has been held to be prosecutorial activities for which absolute immunity applies. Similarly, because a prosecutor is acting as an advocate in the judicial proceedings, the solicitation and subordination of perjured testimony, the withholding of evidence, or the introduction of illegally seized evidence at trial does not create liability and damages. Which goes to what you just said. They can lie, they can cheat, and all that, and they are not held accountable for it.
Yes, and it's unfortunate we don't have a good accountability system for the prosecutors. You've got prosecutors like, I'm going to give a shout out to Alex Hunter, former prosecutor in Boulder, and his chief deputy, Peter Hostrom, who were very honorable, who believed and instilled into their offices about proper conduct. And you've got prosecutors like the Duke LaCrosse case, you remember a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
where he ended up being disbarred, and I forgot what happened to the prosecutor there. So they run the gamut, but holding prosecutors accountable is very difficult because of the immunity they have. So as we evolve as a nation, and I do believe that we evolve as a civilization, we have to look at what we've always done and see if it's time to revisit that notion of prosecutorial immunity. I don't believe it serves us well. And I believe that that combined with something we might do in our future podcast is whether we need to professionalize our juries rather than having the citizen juries, because the complexity of cases now have gotten so far out of the range and zone of what most people can understand that sometimes you have an injustice on both sides. You have a case where the proof was there, the jury didn't understand it, and they acquitted the person. And you have cases where there's not the proof there, but they were bamboozled and snookered. So I'm not sure that the lay jury is the wave of the future if we look at what reforms we need to make. So maybe we can talk about that in the future on an episode down the road.
Hey, Larry,
well, I mean, go ahead, Ben.
I was going to ask if I could ask a question as well. How was it that historically we ended up with prosecutorial immunity? It's turning out to be so bad, but somebody back in the beginning must have thought it was a good idea. Any idea?
I don't know that I can opine with accuracy on how that evolved. If it was a part of our founding, or if it's evolved through years of jurisprudence, I don't know the answer to that.
Well, dang.
But that goes to something we've brought up before, that you could have, pick either side. You could have a weak prosecutor and a stellar rock star defense attorney, and now the guilty guy goes free. And you could flip that over, and you could have a very weak defense attorney and a guy that's not guilty, but you could have a rock star prosecutor and the guy goes to jail.
Yep.
It happens.
It's not fair. That's garbage. That's bullshit.
You can't say that on this podcast. They pull our FCC license.
I say what I want. It's my podcast. I do what I want. But in that article, they talked to about is that the article? No, I'm sorry. There was an article in the other one about
the one with the prosecutorial misconduct?
Where like the guy goes to jail for 16 years and then gets exonerated. I think it was the John Grisham article.
I saw that article.
We were discussing about the guy that served the 16 years or something like that for the wrongful conviction that got exonerated after, you know, from
up
the
in Brooklyn. It was in Brooklyn.
And I thought that's what I was going over in this one.
So
it's just really crappy that that's how things could go down, where people, the perception is that the prosecutors and that whole element of the system is filled with integrity and so forth. And that's not always the case.
Well, Andy, it's unfortunate that humans are flawed creatures, and we have people, the offices by and large in most jurisdictions are elected, certainly at the state level, as federal prosecutors are appointed. But these people have to go out and campaign for offices to be the chief prosecuting officer of a district. And campaigning takes on an interesting twist. Promising to be light on criminals and be fair to criminals is usually not a good platform.
Yeah, I was just about to cover that. Yes.
But
we incentivize it in the wrong direction. If we incentivize something about, I don't know how you measure justice exactly, but if the incentive system is like, I have this really high conviction rate, well, then that's what they go after. That's what you're rewarding. So they would just, you know, the dog crossed the street, we're going to prosecute the dog for crossing the street. But if it's somehow, if you could measure what success would be as far as it being justice being served, the innocent man goes free, the guilty man goes, that should be what the reward should be based upon.
And so, the question is, so how do you get the citizenry engaged enough to do that type of thorough analysis? All they're getting is campaign rhetoric from a prosecutor saying that I'm gonna make you safer, and I'm gonna lock the bad guys up, and I'm gonna max them out, and I'll do whatever it takes to stop the defense attorneys from playing games and manipulating the system. That's what the voter wants to hear.
Yeah, they don't want to listen to any rhetoric about how they're going to be fair and look at all the facts.
So
it just doesn't sell.
Yeah, it just doesn't. So that's why I'm saying we need to revamp our entire system in many ways in terms of how we prosecute people, because the Peter Hofstrom, Alex Hunter model was we do seek justice and we do figure out an appropriate outcome for this case and what serves society and all parties concerned. But that's harder and harder to find. And of course, they're not in office anymore because of the Ramsey case. They were too slow, perceived to be too slow, to file charges, and that just wasn't Alex Hunter's style. He didn't have a case, so he didn't file charges.
And we did elect the guy who's the law and order president, and he has then subsequently put in the AG, who is going after the pot dealers, who were brought into the fold in the last administration, and you know, said, we're not going to go after you. We're going to let this be an experiment and see what happens. And now there's a possibility that they're going to go after all those pot growers.
So elections have consequences. And but back to the point about I don't know how we would get the population on large scale to understand the complexity of. We just tend to take their word for it because they wear pretty outfits and a nice tie, and they have nice haircuts, and if they say they need more prosecutors, we tend to want to give them those resources. There's real no critique takes place. I mean, we're having that discussion here in Albuquerque about we need 400 more police officers, and I can't get a single person to tell me how it is, what rubric you've used to determine what that magic number is that we need to have 50% more officers. They said, well, we had them a long time ago. And I said, well, we had a higher crime rate a long time ago than we have now. So it's taken for granted that if the prosecution side needs resources, they are treated much more with much more deference in terms of those requests, because they wouldn't tell us that if they didn't need them.
Larry, can you tell me something I would rather hear, something that would make me happy?
Yeah, I can. You people need to be careful who you vote for.
Oh, can you tell me about a sheriff down in Alabama who buys homes with the inmate food funds?
I don't think that we can tell you that for certain. What we can tell you, is that it would be amazing that a sheriff without additional resources could buy the real estate that this sheriff in, what is this, Etowah County?
Yeah, I think that's what it is, or Etowah. Yeah, something like that. Some no-name county, some little podunk town, whatever, in Mississippi.
Alabama,
whatever, same
so thing. So it would be surprising. It'd be surprising if he earned more than $100,000 a year as a sheriff.
It says he earns 94, I think I saw. So, 92.
Now sheriffs can't have independent wealth, but what came out of this article is that the unspent food money can be converted to the sheriff's personal funds, it appears. And it also appeared that the food was paid for with another budget other than this budget. That's how there was so much left over. So if there's a provision that allows a sheriff to convert what should be used for feeding prisoners to their personal use, that certainly begs the question, because I've interviewed a lot of people in correctional institutions through my life, and the typical complaint and the food diets I've seen, they're heavily laden in carbohydrates, very little, if any, fresh food, very little fiber. And if he had all that money left over, perhaps maybe they could have added a little bit of variety to make for a healthier diet for the prisoners, possibly.
You don't go inside and come out and you're fat. That's for damn sure.
You mean those carbs don't put on the pounds?
Well, they do, but they're not in the right place. And then besides, there's not that many of them.
So
they still, it's not like they overfeed you. It's not like you're getting fed 3,000 calories a day and you can just load it on.
So, but did you ever, when you analyzed your meals, did you ever notice that there was any fresh fruit? Did you ever find that?
No, there was never anything like that.
Was then in terms of fiber, a body needs fiber for healthy digestion. What did you have in the way of a fiber content? I mean,
if they wanted you to have fiber, then they would have to increase the capacity of the septic system because there'd be a lot more flushing, and they don't want to have that either.
So a healthy diet needs a little bit more than just carbs.
Bread and water, man. That's what we need to feed them is bread and water.
Well, they won't come back. That's the Joe Arpaio model.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, it sounds good in theory until it's you on the inside. And as probably most of us playing in this arena understand, is like we didn't care about it until we got somehow attached to it, either personally or through 1 or 2 degrees of separation out.
Yeah.
But this dude has $750,000 in real estate, making $92,000. And of course, he could be living on $20,000 a year with him and his wife and family, and their bank and all the rest of it so that he can buy a nice house. He could be super duper frugal.
Could be, Andy, but regardless of that, the provision of the law should not be there that allows the money to be reverted to the sheriff himself. That's a conflict, a blatant conflict.
It definitely sounds like it. Well, this next article is from Criminal Legal News, and it is authored in part by our guest tonight, Brenda Jones, and the title is Unjust Sexual Offense Laws, Insanity and Hope. And I was excited to have Brenda on to go over the article with us and talk about different points on it. So, Brenda, tell us what the idea behind the article is.
Well, the idea behind the article was simply to introduce the criminal legal news community to some facts about sexual offense laws as we understood them. Ken, my co-author, was approached about that, and we tried to keep it fairly basic and in discussing just some common misperceptions about sexual offense laws.
One of the things that I read recently, and I somehow lost the article, but a lady in Pennsylvania ended up on the registry because she violated a custody agreement. Whatever, she takes her kid out to lunch for 3 hours. And that goes against what the judge's orders were. So now she's on the sex offender registry for having lunch with her kid. Huh. But people would see her online and they would see sex offender. So that, all the baggage that comes with that, whether somebody molested 25 3-year-olds and she just took her kid out to lunch.
Be interested to hear that case. She must have already had some kind of restriction for something else to get that. But yeah.
And that was one of the things that the Pennsylvania law was going back and adjusting and letting the 17,000 people off, was to take crimes like that or, you know, situations, misdemeanors off the radar of it. There seems to be only evidence suggesting a low rate of recidivism. But there's all this hoopla that goes around that the recidivism rate is frightening and high.
Yeah. One of the things, I tend to not go into that as much. That was a piece that my co-author wrote. I do like to point out regularly that there's a misperception about persons who are required to register or convicted of offenses, that they are all dangerous and all fit some kind of a stereotype. And frankly, I think the average person, including a lot of people convicted of sexual offenses, if they don't know any better, honestly think that if you're put on a registry, then that means you are a danger. Because why else would you put someone on a registry? This would be logical, yes? So they're quite shocked, oftentimes, to find out that the majority of people on registries do not fit that perception. And yeah, that's why so often we hear among our advocates, I'm not a sex offender. What do you mean you're not a sex offender? You were convicted of a sex offense, right? Yeah, but I'm not like the other people on the list, because they also assume that list is for, you know, only for that stereotype. So that's part of what we were trying to deal with in that article, is that that stereotype, that real narrow image, you know, the guy in the trench coat with multiple offenses and, you know, high risk, et cetera, is the only people that are on the list.
And Larry, so, we had that call and the lady said, well, my son's not a sex offender.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember that, Andy.
She was adamant that her son, he did something wrong, but he's not like those people,
those,
you know, not
people.
Like you people. He's not one of those people and he shouldn't be on the registry.
Yeah.
And what did you say, Larry?
Well, I don't remember, but I remember it was not very flattering.
Well, you asked her, you said, well, did he get convicted of a sexual offense? She's like, well, yes. Well, then, ma'am, your son's a sex offender.
I remember it was not as patient as I should have been.
You were definitely not, but
no,
still.
It is a challenge. And every many new people that come on have some bit of that. I remember, you know, back in my 2009, 2010 days, just getting involved and finding out about a registry in the first place, because that's how clueless I was. And, you know, my thought was, my family member did something wrong, but he's not a monster. He's not defined by that one thing he did. And, like, I knew that. And that's what I came in with. And I think that's sort of what all the other people are trying to say. But they have, unlike me, where I was coming in, you know, totally unaware of any of this stuff, you know, they have heard about registries and they have these wrong images of who's on a registry. So they're starting from my kid, my husband, my significant other, me. I don't fit that image. And that's, you know, so you start with that and then you've got to work back to what is rational, what is the right description. It's the big thing I think that we at NARSOL are fighting and trying to do, is we trying to change and correct that image. We have to do it constantly with our own people and then of course constantly with the larger public that we're trying to reach. So it's a big task.
I don't have a well-formed thought on how to ask this question. How do we deliver that message of retraining how they think to try and advance that to be the predominant thought process for at least our people, our advocates?
Well, the one thing that we've tried to do and would like to continue to do more is we're learning how to tell stories and humanize persons who are on the registry. And we have a project, Humans on the Registry, which is a little bit like Humans of New York, if you're familiar with that particular, I don't know if you call that a blog, I guess it is, where registrants tell a positive story about themselves, that it might mention the registry or it might not, but it lets them tell what they're proud of and how proud they are of their kids or of succeeding in a new business or having a good stable home life, just whatever it is that's makes them happy. And it's not long, it's just a short little story, but they happen to be sex offenders. They happen to be people on that list. And the hope is that we build up enough of those stories, then people can say, oh, well, that doesn't sound like that stereotype. So that's one of the things we're doing. And if that takes off, then we'd like to see some video type pieces, you know, little vignettes, stories there where we get the same kind of a story, but it's visual. Yeah, it's a video. So we're still developing that. So that's one way. And I think also how we deliver our own message. We've been trying to learn about that, delivering the message so that we're not constantly inadvertently reinforcing the myths. You know, so often we'll start off by saying, Now, you may have heard that sex offenders are constantly reoffending, but, and then you launch into your, you know, correct, that person has just had that myth reinforced and they're not going to hear a word you're saying about the right stuff.
Right.
You know, so finding a, you know, changing our own message so that we're pushing the positive thing and keeping those negative and incorrect images out. And it's a challenge because, you know, we spent a number of years going at it the other way. So, yeah, switching it around and focusing on the right messages and the more positive and correct ones has been a bit of a challenge. But those are two things that we're trying to do at NARSL now.
Tell me a little bit some other areas of advocacy work that people could get involved in besides going and talking to their local politicians. What else could people do to become active and help out?
You know, I think the biggest thing that any of us can do is to get out of our shells. And it's also, I think, but one of the hardest, maybe as hard or harder than going and talking to a legislator, is talking to our neighbors, is talking to our friends and family online, is talking to somebody that you overhear talking in the supermarket and correcting them when they misspeak. You know, if they're saying something, you know, share your story or share some facts. But go ahead and get out there and say something. It's going to take a movement like that. And it's not easy. It sounds easy to say, turn around and talk. But for most of us, it's hard because we don't know how we'll be received. And we're scared of a negative reaction or, you know, but the more we do it, the more that word's going to get out.
Okay. Larry, what do you think about advocacy work and other areas that can help move us along?
We need more of it.
just flat out, just more of it, whatever it is,
more of it, whatever it is.
No, that's a loaded question because the advocacy is unique to each individual state, each individual governmental entity, local counties and city ordinances you have in play. And it's so different. A big state like California, a small state like Wyoming. So training advocates and that's what we're up against is people have never done it and we're starting from scratch. And it's a long haul because we don't have millions of dollars just to hire the people that are out there that know how to do. I mean, we know how to do these things at the national level. We have the expertise. We just don't have the resources to put on the ground where they're needed. So advocacy is a grounds, or it's we're trying to start at ground level with people who have never done anything before. And it's tough because this is not an issue that you just don't feel proud when you do things to help disadvantaged children. You feel proud. I mean, how many people, when they say, what have you been doing a lot of your volunteering your time? Oh, we've been advocating for sex offenders. Brenda, tell me how that goes for you when you're at a social gathering when you do that.
Yeah, exactly. I even when I show up the legislature, you know, often there's plenty of other people wandering up and down the halls waiting for their turn to talk to somebody or at a hearing or whatever. And you find yourself sitting around waiting for your turn out in the hall, and somebody will strike up a conversation and I'll say, so what are you advocating for? You know, well, and my initial response is usually, well, I advocate for the most unpopular cause in the United States. And they go, ha ha ha, that's really funny. What is it? And I say, well, I advocate for the civil rights of people who've been convicted of sex offenses. And there's this long pause. Oh, that would be tough. So it's like, you know, that would be. And sometimes it goes on from there, you know, to a bit of a conversation. And other times it's like, I'm getting out here as fast as possible. So you just never know. But people have never been rude about it.
What would you do? What would each of you do if you had a blank check? What would you do with an unlimited amount of money to try and push things along and fix things?
Well, I know what I would probably, if I had a big blank check here in the state, I'd probably hire myself a lobbyist. part-time lobbyist to really follow the issues and develop relationships, if they didn't already have them, with key legislators, and look for bills that could be introduced and passed and that sort of thing. That's what I'd do with mine.
Larry?
I would do a similar thing. I would really enhance our, you got to go into the killing business before you can go into the passing business. So I would focus on halting all legislation that's going forward in the chambers around the country. And then once we get to where we can stop the forward momentum, then I would look for ways to begin to peel the onion back and pull these things down. And it's going to be slow and painful for people, because there's no way to just repeal the registry. And I hope we do a podcast about that someday, because that's one of the most common questions we get is, why don't you people just do away with the registry? Why these baby steps? So there's no way to do that. Can't just repeal the registry.
Right. Well, we'll put it on the docket. All right. So our final article, I've got a couple of news clips if you guys are ready for it. Audio clips, that is.
Sure.
I think you're going to like these, Larry. So let your hair down.
We were looking at about 17,000 people being removed from the SORNA list. Obviously, that puts the public at risk.
So that's State Senator Guy Reschenthaler. I know I'm totally botching that name. But he says, unless we keep those 17, 18,000 people on the registry in Pennsylvania, then you have a public safety issue.
It does sound like that's what he said, yes.
Bunch of hogwash.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's where I wanted to go with this. How do we know that those 18,000 people are a public safety risk?
He doesn't.
But he is obviously going to get votes for his campaign, because he's going to make sure that the 18,000 people stay on the list.
Well, let me turn it back on you. How many phone calls were made to Guy Reschenthaler saying, I can't believe I heard you say that, sir. I find that distasteful. And I am so interested in you as a candidate that I will be registering complete resentment to you at the polls next time. Do you think he got any calls like that?
I'm going to go with, well, I don't know. Pennsylvania has become somewhat of an active group. He might have.
I would be very surprised if he got a phone call like that. So
I would say out of the, if he got, say, 1,000 calls, he might have got one or two.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
Our politicians are a reflection of us. And I anger people when I say that, but he's merely reflecting public opinion. He's not creating it. Public opinion believes that there is a risk without this list. And he's merely placating public opinion by saying that. I disagree with it. You could turn off the list completely, and I don't think there'd be any change in public safety. But he's merely playing to his constituents. But he should have gotten hundreds of phone calls saying, why don't you substantiate what you said?
So from that angle, though, if the list is only there to announce to your neighbors that you committed some kind of crime and that you live next door, and I'll ask this again, do they have a right to know who you are?
Well, I get the chance to say it depends, but basically, no, they don't.
Your conviction is public record, but to just have your name on a website, that's not constitutionally required.
The fact of your conviction under current American jurisprudence is our court records are open. But perhaps when you're paying your debt to society while you're under supervision, perhaps the state has the right to apprise the citizens of where it's deploying its probation supervision resources. But once you have paid your debt to society and you've exited all those responsibilities, there is no right to know. And people who believe there is a right to know, I would challenge them to come on the podcast, write to us, and tell us what it is you'd like to show that gives you a right to know that you do not have. You don't have the right to know. That's not a part of their conviction. Where they're going to be living 20 years from after their conviction is not anything that you have a right to know.
Hear, hear.
I have another clip. So let's see what he says here.
No one wants to have a law that's ex post facto, that's clearly unconstitutional. But you have to balance that with the safety of the community and making sure that there aren't further victims.
So again, he's doubling down on there's the public safety element that the registry exhibits.
So he wants to, he's trying to pay lip service to the fact that he's got a court decision that has said they can't go retroactively, you know, reaching back and throwing people on a registry after they've done their time. Okay, okay, well, we'll try to do that. But, he says, somehow we've got to keep our people safe. So.
And does the registry keep people safe?
Of course not. And we're getting more and more, we're getting more and more actual studies and evidence to show that there's no statistical difference. I am not one to go throwing around absolutes where I say there's never been a child saved by the registry, because somebody will call me out on that. But I can say that statistically, there is no statistical difference pre and post registry anywhere that anybody's been able to find. It's minimal at best.
Larry?
I can't say it any better. The only thing that they come back with is if it saves one, and we can get to that again or maybe later, but that's nonsense in my opinion.
Well, we have covered, we've touched around that. We could come up with, I have a handful of examples of where if it saves one, then we should outlaw cigarettes. I mean, we would save many lives, not just one child, if we outlawed cigarettes. If we, you know, car safety, or the list would go on and on and on until you're wrapped in bubble. And you can't even leave the house because you might slip and fall and break your ankle. If it saves one, if you want to push it to that extreme, it's impossible to save everyone.
It is. But then when you get down to our cause, you have to come back with balance it with the Constitution. People have the right to enact public policies that are misguided. So, but you don't have the right to trample the Constitution. So, I always. My answer is I'll do a trade-off. I'll trample the Constitution for 800,000 people on the sex offender registry, and I'll proudly look at them in the eye and say, we're going to trample your rights. But I want the NRA to do the same thing, because I can assure you that if we take prudent measures to tighten the distribution of guns, we will save at least one. And if it's worth it to save one child, I'm willing to trample the Constitution. Are you? And of course, I'm not really willing to trample the Constitution, but I want to make the point that the Constitution is precious and we shouldn't trample it in any circumstance, even if it does save one.
Yeah, it's a gambit. It's a, you know, you're bluffing. So you're getting them to not, they're not going to accept the deal. Yeah,
they will not agree to trample the Constitution.
Damn it.
Every time he gets excited, he drops.
I know, really. You're overloading the packets, Larry.
Am I back?
You are back now.
So I was saying that it's. I'm calling them out on their hypocrisy because they say if it saves one, so I say, okay, I buy in. I will go along with you to save one. So let's start trampling the Constitution. Let's pick your precious gun ownership right, and let's see if we can trample the Constitution on that to save one. And they magically become the hypocrites they are because they really don't mean if it saves one. Because there's a lot of things that we could do that trample the Constitution to save one. But we have to be careful about trampling the Constitution because first thing you know, we don't have a Constitution if we start disregarding it because the outcome is good. The Constitution builds parameters around what government can't do. And the government cannot punish people after they've done their time. That's in the main Constitution itself. It's not in the Bill of Rights. There shall be no ex post facto punishment. The government shall impose no ex post facto laws. You just can't do it, regardless if it saves one.
If you want someone to serve the entire existence that they are left on Earth, then you would have to write the law to say that you will be on lifetime registration. That has to be
a part of the punishment, and that would be part of what people would propose. You would have the advocates like the Lisa Jordan type in Maryland, who's the one that comes in always with things to try to make life for sex offenders more miserable. She would come in and say, well, let's just make them part of their sentence. They would have to serve the registry for life. Then we would have to come up with new arguments. If that got passed, we would have to argue that is cruel, unusual, and excessive punishment. Might or might not win. In Maryland, you might could win on that because they have a little bit stronger constitutional protections than the U.S. Constitution.
We do.
I don't know anything about that. No, seriously, I've never heard that. How is that a thing?
How is it stronger? It's just the way it's worded. And Larry's probably better, but ours simply says restraint, as I recall.
Disadvantages. There are a number of states that have a greater constitution. The U.S. Constitution requires that the state has to meet a minimum standard. The states can provide their citizens greater protections as long as they meet the minimum. So right. There are states who provide greater protections for their citizens. Maryland's one of them. They have I think it's Article 17 in their constitution. There's a declaration of that says that you cannot impose any disadvantage. So that's greater than just ex post facto. That's been interpreted to mean any disadvantage, and that's how they were able.
Disadvantages, needless to say, covers a broader range than punishment.
Disadvantage would be the checking the box that says you've been convicted of a felony.
It could. Yep. It could. If it's applied retroactively, but yeah, it's in this case that would have been ongoing.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. What is your opinion of what's going to happen in the Pennsylvania? Are they going to continue to challenge and push back on the people with the governor signing the new law?
Well, I would anticipate after a complete analysis what the impact is going to be, there will probably have to be new litigation because the state is determined to keep as many people on the register as they can. And I took a lot of criticism for saying that after the decision came out to begin with, that very few states just throw in the towel and say, we give up. They're going to look for a way to keep as many people as they can registered. And that's what Representative Reschenthaler said.
When do you think it kicks in where the statistics do matter that say there's no evidence that having a registry does anything for public safety, that there's no difference between having and not having a registry? Do you think that ever tilts the scale?
Well, it depends on where you're talking about. It can tip the scale in the legislative arena, but in the judicial arena, the courts don't exist to save us from stupid decisions we make.
Right, we talked about that before.
So if we are willing to impose bad public policies on ourselves, and they're not unconstitutional, we have every right to do that. So again, elections have consequences. So the courts' statistics will only matter to the courts when we can prove that the registry deserves merely registration of itself, deserves a higher level of scrutiny than what's rational basis, that there's some such fundamental rights implicated that it has to get intermediate or strict scrutiny. And I don't think we'll ever get to the strict scrutiny, but if we can just get the intermediate scrutiny. But right now, the basis that the courts look at is a rational basis. So the rational basis is that the people want to protect the community. Whether or not it achieves the result is not for the courts to analyze. And that's where we get hung up. We think the courts are supposed to sit there and do an analysis and say, well, let's look at this. Well, the registry doesn't save people. That's not the analysis they do. The analysis they do was the idea that you wanted to save people rational, not did this achieve the desired result. Doesn't have to.
And that has everything to do with who we vote for. If we vote for a bunch of politicians that make our lives more difficult, and then we bitch about those people making our lives more difficult, well, we should just go suck an egg.
Well, it's more complicated than that because this is a bipartisan issue in terms of,
yeah, no doubt.
As long as the masses want the registry, it's difficult. We have to somehow change public opinion. And that's another thing we'd spend all that money on if we had unlimited funds, would be trying to educate and change public opinion.
We need a law and order type show that is favorable to the defense side.
It's just so difficult. I really do find that. I mean, Larry's right. It's not a, you know, progressive, conservative, radical, liberal, whatever kind of split. It really is a fundamental bit of our society now that we're afraid.
Yes.
And we're being fed all this fear. And you could be the most liberal person out there and have this totally overwhelming fear of the boogeyman. And you can define your boogeyman however you want. We know how we're defining him on this show, but and that it won't matter what your politics are. you want your government to protect you from that boogeyman. And so the very base core thing that has to be changed is that fear, ultimately. You know, you've got to break that image of what you're afraid of and realize that it's largely a figment.
Then isn't that where the statistics do play, to say that there's literally no risk involved in letting your kids go outside and play? They're not going to get snatched up and disappear.
I wish it were that easy. The reality is that statistics tend not to change minds. Stories change minds.
Fair.
And that's, you know, we need to know those statistics. Larry and I have this discussion often, you know, about recidivism even. We as advocates need to know those statistics. We need to know the truth so that when the wrong ones get tossed up to make the fear stronger, we just simply say, you're wrong. But the thing that's going to change that gut level, I mean, that's coming from a whole different part of your brain. So to break out of that fear, you've got to replace it with something not fearful. and so it's a lot more challenging. And that's why I say the stories, the images of real humans, stories about family members, you know, the harm to innocent family members who are trying to support their loved one, and kids that don't, you know, that don't have their daddies with them because they're not allowed to live at home, or just, you know, that kind of thing. Hearing those stories, that breaks those stereotypes, and it breaks you out of that fear. So, I can't stress that enough.
Sure. So, Larry, we have a lady emailed us. Patty emailed, and she said, "Hi, I appreciate the podcast, and I have a question about the registry. I'm in Ohio. Next to some of the names, it says pre-AWA, which I know is the Adam Walsh Act, but why is pre-AWA put there? Thanks. Keep up the good work."
Great question. Those are people whose offense conduct predated. Ohio was quick, the first state to, after the Adam Walsh Act passed the U.S. Congress in 2006, they wanted to get the bonus implementation early money. So they were the first state in 2007 to pass, I believe it was Senate Bill 10. And they were declared substantially compliant, and they got their bonus money. Of course, it cost them millions in litigation subsequently. But when the courts in two cases, I believe it was Williams and Bodike, however they pronounce it, they had two cases where, for various reasons, ex post facto and separation of powers, they declared that they could not apply the Adam Walsh Act. Well, there technically was no registration requirement because Senate Bill 10 had repealed the previous version of Megan's Law. I think they had two or maybe three versions of Megan's Law in effect, but there was effectively no registration. So the court reinstated a law, which is questionable. But so they end up with people who are in Megan's Law, and they're pre-AWA offenders. So they have lesser standards to adhere to in terms of people that are under the 2007 version of Ohio's law. So if you're pre-AWA, your conduct has occurred prior to the enactment of Senate Bill 10.
All right, then.
So great question, though.
I thought it was. When it came in, I was like, man, that's a really good question. It's just simple, concise. It was something that's not kind of on the fringes or anything like that. Yeah, I thought it was great. Thank you so much, Patty, for writing in. So, Larry, how can people reach out to us and ask a question?
They can visit the website. Yeah, the website.
Okay, Elmer Fudd.
registrymatters.co, or they can email the registrymatterscast@gmail.com. That's registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Or you can use a very inefficient form of communication. You can call or even text 747-227-4477. That's 747-227-4477.
Wow.
And we'll actually play your recording of your question. If it's if it's audible.
I was going to add to that. Yeah, I would really like to have a whole bunch of phone calls come in so that we could even have like a Q&A session show with, you know, 10 or 15, you know, whatever, people phoning in and voicemailing a question. You could even record it on your phone and email it to the email address listed. And yeah, that would be a great way to have a show, I think, just a Q&A session.
So, well, I've heard rumors that we can do a live Q&A, but I haven't, we haven't actually done it yet.
We totally could. However, anybody wants to get on the show, I could probably pull off how to get you on here. But I think that pretty much wraps it all up. Anybody have any closing remarks they would like to make?
So it's a great job you do here, Andy, with all the work putting this together.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Brenda, I so very much appreciate having you. And on short notice.
It's been fun.
Thank you so very much. I hope you guys have a good night, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
So if you made it this far and you're still listening, I would just like to add a personal message here at the end of the show. Since you're listening, first of all, I really, really appreciate that you're here. And if I could ask for a personal favor, that you share this podcast with someone who is impacted by the registry so that we can try and, A, grow our numbers for the podcast, but try and get more people to get involved in helping us move this movement forward. I so very much appreciate it, and I'll talk to you guys soon.